Everybody, welcome to Booktales with Rand Dugas and Heather Fowler. Today we're excited to feature Shandell Beers reading from her newest book of poems, Secure Your Own Mask, published by White Pine Press, winner of the White Pine Press Poetry Prize.
Booktales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. We feature literary poets, fiction writers, and creative nonfiction writers. We're so pleased to have Shandell with us today reading from her collection.
For those not familiar with Shandell Beer's work, her poetry, fiction, and creative nonfiction have appeared in numerous journals and anthologies. She is an English instructor at Blue Mountain Community College in Pendleton, Oregon, and serves as poetry editor of Contrary. A Brief History of Time, her first full-length poetry collection, was released by Salt Publishing in 2009. Her second collection, The Children's War and Other Poems, was released in February of 2013. Her most recent collection, Secure Your Own Mask, is what we will hear her reading from today. Shandell has been praised by many readers and authors for the depth and intensity of her poetry. One of my favorite endorsements of this book is by poet Maggie Smith, author of Good Bones, who says of Shandell's work, quote, "From the opening poem of Secure Your Own Mask, I was hooked. This book rings and rings in searing lyrics. Shandell Beers explores beauty and violence and the voyeuristic impulse toward an unhealthy human appetite for both. The poem's not only unflinching, but also open, even warm. Secure Your Own Mask is a remarkable collection. These poems are quite literally death-defying," end quote. Wow, strong words. But then I've read this book twice and I feel the same way. Hi, Shandell. How are you feeling today?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day in the Oregon desert.
Great. We're looking forward to talking about your journey as an author. We're excited you're going to read excerpts of poems from Secure Your Own Mask for us today. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
I do. One of the strange things with the pandemic is the whole sort of Zoom reading, but which I am very grateful for. And in some ways, it's very nice, but it's really surreal. So even though I would say I'm kind of an introvert, it's just weird to not actually be in bookstores or in art centers or, you know, places with real life people reading.
Is it easier being an introvert given the online readings versus the live readings?
I think that the one thing that's easier for me is, and I'm like that line of like, I'm actually an ENFP if you're into Myers-Briggs. I'm the most introverted type of extrovert. For me, it's more, there's usually some anxiety with getting ready. Like, what do I wear? What if I say something completely embarrassing? And being in my home office where I am completely comfortable and giving a reading in some ways is a lot easier, but there is some sort of like different energy that you totally miss from being around people.
Yeah, you don't get that feedback from the audience. Or you never know who's going to walk across a screen or something like that.
Or whose cat's going to pop up.
Right. The one strange thing is when the amazing poet Eve Van Bolen passed away, I thought, I'm going to do a YouTube video and read one of my favorite poems of hers. And in the next room, my son was playing a video game with my husband and you could barely hear them, but that at the end, you know, my son's like a very excited 9-year-old. And he's like, I'm shot. I'm dying. And I was like, oh my God. The end of this poetry reading.
I bet that was mortifying.
Yeah. And I mean, you would have to crank it up like on purpose to hear the ends. But I was like, I asked my family to be quiet for 2 minutes and that didn't happen.
Which is why you're at the office today.
Exactly, yes.
Well, I'm interested to know how this book fits in with your author trajectory. Can you talk a little bit about how it connects with other books you've written or if it does?
Yeah, I feel like I'm one of those people that sort of just writes whatever I'm going to write. Like, I've never really been like, oh, I have a vision for this book. So my first book, A Brief History of Time, is really autobiographical, what it was like to grow up in a very small farm town and then sort of figure out the larger world after that. The Children's War and Other Poems was kind of more of a project book. I was reading a Slate.com Medicine.com article about the history of art therapy and how it had been used for children war survivors from the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s to current times. And so that one, I really did sort of get obsessed, and I looked at all of these art pieces by child war survivors and wrote about them. But Secure Your Own Mask, I sort of just wrote for several years, and then I thought, oh my goodness, I probably have enough poems to put a book together. And I kind of printed everything out, and I had a lot, but I didn't know what to weed out, how to arrange it. So actually, Jennifer Gavon, who's an amazing writer, I just sort of said, I know there's a book here. I believe in paying other writers, you know, even if we're friends.
Right.
Can I send you money and send you all these poems and you'll help me? And
wow,
she did.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And so I really needed someone to sort of help me find the book in this giant pile of stuff that I'd written.
I can imagine.
I'm so jealous. I'm totally jealous. That's amazing that you found someone. I mean, how can you even conceive of knowing who to hand over that big of a stack of your poems to? That just seems like such an amazing and wonderful thing for you to have found.
Right. Well, I feel like Jennifer really gets me. We first met, it must have been 10 years ago at CSU Fullerton. We were both guest poets for a workshop. And I just really feel like she understands, not to pigeonhole any of us, but definitely understands women's poetry, women's issues, anything with motherhood or domestic violence, you know, because I really wanted a reader who was sensitive to those things. And it's not that I don't think men can't do that, but I would have to be very comfortable with a male author to ask someone to look at all of the deepest, darkest stuff I've ever written and then be like, can you help me shape this?
So how did you come up with the arrangement for this book? Were you, you know, was she helping you with that? Did she decide what went where?
She is magical. I never would have thought arranging it the way that she did in sections, but she was really like, this is section one, this is section two, the Pelican poems will be their own little chapbook.
And then, that's amazing.
Yeah. And so I'm just so indebted to her. She's absolutely brilliant.
I can't say I'm jealous enough. You know, I love the Pelican poems and the idea that you're talking about with that, but I love how much nature is always coming through in your narratives. And it's quite beautiful. It always makes me think of how some authors focus on the issue of setting. Some authors are really tuned in to the natural world and the natural environment. So I know that sometimes you often post involving animals, and I want you to talk to us a little bit about living in Oregon. How does Oregon as a place impact your work? I see that you often post beautiful shots of nature and wildlife. Sometimes this really moves through your work, for example, as a deer on the cover of Secure Your Own Mask. Can you speak to your relationship with animals and the wild?
Yeah, well, what I really like about where I live is I'm in Eastern Oregon, which is the desert, and a lot of people just think of Portland as Oregon. So,
wow.
Yeah. So like when I say that I live in Oregon, people are like, oh, you must like rain. And I'm like, well, I'm in the desert. You know, it rains 19 inches a year. But I just really like, I'm trying to think of how to explain it. A lot of times the hills are just brown or yellow hills, but then there's wildflower season and it's just beautiful everywhere. Mm. Or there are so many rivers. And so, you know, if you're near a river, you're going to see water birds, you're going to see like deer that are coming to the river to drink. You know, I just really just love this place.
I love that we get to experience it through your work. Can you maybe talk to us a little bit about the cover? I am really interested in how this cover got chosen for this particular book.
I know. I wanted to ask about the cover too.
Yeah, the cover was, it's an illustration by a former student of mine, Elde de la Cruz. And he is an artist who now lives in Portland. And I did not have like a clear vision for the cover. I had just said, you're one of the best students I've ever had in my career. I love you as an artist. He's also an amazing poet. He was my assistant poetry editor at Contrary for a while. And I just gave him the manuscript and said, what would you come up with? And the deer in the first poem really spoke to him. So this is what he came up with, basically.
How wonderful.
Yeah.
I love that. Can I ask, how does being a poet impact your lifestyle? You talked a little bit about living in Oregon, but how does being a poet really sort of shape your life?
I think everyone needs their own way to process life. And to me, poetry mm-hmm. is just the way to do it. Something happens and I think about it, and then eventually it becomes a poem.
Very organic.
Interesting. So as far as how things are going right now in the world, I was curious just how your creative process has been. How have you been? Have you been able to write, or how have you been doing with all that?
As far as poetry, I really tried to do like the April poem a day challenge. And I think I only got like probably one good poem out of all of that. It's just, there's so much going on. I feel like a lot of us are sort of just processing too much stuff to be able to make anything out of it. I have been writing and sending out a lot of fiction and flash fiction, because I feel like poetry to me, a lot of my poetry is very autobiographical. And right now, I mean, there's so many ways to look at this, but with all of the Black Lives Matter things happening, I feel like maybe it is a time for white people in general to be quiet and listen and not put their own work out there. And so to me, poetry is very personal. I think I'm able to write fiction because I'm completely making things up. So it's not connected to what's happening right now.
It's almost like two different things going on.
Yeah. I mean, you write in other genres as well, though. So how do you decide what exactly you're going to do next? Do you do some poetry? You do some fiction? Do you do any playwriting? Anything like that? Do you do performative writing at all?
Performative as in...
When I say performative, I mean drama, like writing for theater, writing for perhaps like some sort of improv troupes, maybe doing something that you expect other people or authors or actors to be performing?
Yeah, no. I mean, it's interesting to think about. I am not that kind of person. I don't know. It would be interesting if I could. But yeah, that's something interesting to think about.
It's fun. It's a lot of fun. I'm kind of getting excited about getting into writing for theater and writing for example, screenplays and things like that. So I'm always curious what other authors are doing. What's the difference between your inspiration for fiction and your inspiration for poetry?
Well, I actually recently took Kathy Fish's Fast Flash workshop. And then if you pay for one of her workshops, you get all these like little bonus, like surprise workshops that are free. And so I've just been writing from a lot of writing prompts that she gave. And I'm trying to think. I think I go back to sort of fictionalizing real life things from my childhood. So there's a lot of like, you know, small town, cornfield, Midwestern feeling sort of things. And I wonder if that's because it feels like a place of comfort and a simpler time than things that were before.
Oh, yeah. And everybody needs some comfort right now, too. Do you think a lot of people are moving towards comfort entertainment these days while the pandemic's going on? I mean, it's just there's so much upheaval and so many unknowns in so many ways. I'm wondering if that's impacting other people too. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I know a lot of people have talked about like, I can't watch new TV shows, so I'm rewatching this series, or I can't read new books, so I'm rereading this thing. And so I think that it's sort of a societal thing where people are having trouble processing new stuff because there's so much of it.
Oh yeah, that's true. Now, we are really in a place and time in history that is unique. So what's on your reading table right now? Or is there a book you've recently read that you couldn't put down?
Okay, well, this is going to feel like a weird love letter to Jennifer Gavon, I guess, because I just said she helped me with my book so much. I just read her sci-fi novel, Trinity Site, and it's brilliant. Basically, Jennifer is a Mexican-American woman, and so she was really interested in looking at stories and myths and legend from her ancestors. And so she wrote this sort of kind of post-apocalyptic novel of what if those old stories of her ancestors were coming true. And it's just super powerful. I really appreciated the fact that it was sci-fi and sort of ancient religions, anthropology, just really interesting stuff.
Well, as far as poets, tell us some of the poets that are on your can't do without list or influences for you.
Definitely Evan Boland, who I mentioned. Joy Harjo has always been really important to me. I'm trying to think of who I keep sort of going back to. I mean, I I would consider Anne Sexton a major influence because I loved all of her transformations, you know, and I think that goes along with what we're talking about. Maybe we're not ready to make new things or read new things, but we can redo fairy tales and myths and things like that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, how you live your life as someone in the world who's a writer, but also a mentor and an influencer. I know you have a really active writing agenda and you act as a faculty member for college students, but plus you also have a very vibrant presence on Twitter. As Susan Sontag says, many women wear many hats. So can you speak to what you enjoy most about each of those roles?
These are all so interesting. I'm like, oh my goodness. Well, I mean, as far as being a writer, it's just, to me, it's the one art where you don't really need materials or need to be in a certain place. You just have your ideas and paper or a laptop and you're good. It's not like you need paint or scenery or a stage. And so I really like creating that way. As far as teaching, I just have so many amazing students who are finding their way. And especially right now, I feel like my spring term that I just finished teaching a few weeks ago, so many students were happy to have a college class and reading materials and discussion boards.
Aww.
Because if you are quarantining at home, that gives you a sense of community. If you are an essential worker dealing with people who might not be pleasant, your classwork could be a good escape.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And as far as social media, I don't know. I guess I feel like I'm sort of just myself. So, you know, if I'm cooking, here are, you know, like pictures of what I'm cooking.
Yeah, I love that so much. I love how bold you are so much. So what do you think is the most important thing for women poets to do to gain legitimacy or visibility for their work? What could you tell your female students, for example, who want to be poets, or maybe some aspiring poets you interact with on social media?
Yeah, they're so good. I think just write what you're going to write. Don't let anyone tell you what you should be writing. Don't let someone say, oh, don't write mommy poems, or don't write love poems, or, you know, I feel like a lot of writers try to tell female writers what to do.
I hate that.
And I feel like a lot of male writers do this weird game of comparing female writers to each other. Like they don't think of them as just writers. And I mean, obviously, if you are a woman and you write, you're a woman writer. If you are African-American and you write, you're an African-American writer. But not letting other people define you, I think, is really important. Because I have had people say, don't write mommy poems, or can't you write about something other than domestic violence? And I feel like, well, I do. I think people are more quick to label women writers for some reason.
Oh, yeah. Like as if our topics are not as valid, or as if someone who's a really excellent writer may or may not be considered as excellent as they are if people are willing to diminish whatever the subject matter is. Do you ever find that people think it's a compliment when they compare you to a male author? Like if you're a female author and they say, oh, writes like Borges, or writes like Vonnegut, or writes like Nabokov, then for some reason, it's like they're saying, oh, you're an exceptional female writer because we're going to connect you to a male author.
I don't know. That's really interesting. Me, I feel like a lot of times they don't even think of you in the same category as male authors. Or if they compare you to a female author, it's like a weird almost, oh, I'm trying to think. Like in my book, Secure Your Own Mask, I end with a poem evoking Mary Oliver.
I love her.
And a male writer said, I don't know if you want to do that because you are a better poet than Mary Oliver.
Oh, there's so much elitism. I can't stand it. I think she's very excellent. I mean, don't you?
Yeah.
Those poems are hard to write. They may seem simple, but they are not.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no.
No, but that was exactly, like, I feel like this man thought he was complimenting me, and I almost thought, well, you just don't get Mary Oliver that.
Uh-huh, exactly. Oh, my goodness. I would have been so pissed.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Well, I also wanted to ask, while you were talking about your female students, if you have any other advice for new writers who want to start sharing or publishing their work, new poets.
I think it's just really important to read a lot and to read widely.
Mm-hmm.
Especially now, people seem to be, and I mean, I'm guilty of it too. Like, I scroll on my phone in bed for a half hour or whatever before I pick up the book that I'm going to read. But I think a lot of people are not reading as much as they used to, and they're not reading very widely. Like, they're just reading,
you're right about that,
like what they already like and what they already know.
Yeah, or Netflixing or doing anything that gives you kind of an easier entertainment a little bit.
I think it goes back to what Chandel was saying at the beginning too, that comfort. Like, it's easier to be sort of mindless and scroll or watch an old movie or something like that than read a book where we need to engage more, because it's a new art.
So we are so much looking forward to hearing you read from Secure Your Own Mask today. I have to tell everybody out there that you're in for a huge treat.
Before we do that, though, for anybody listening out there, let's talk about the cocktail for a second. In case you want to make it and drink and listen at home, the recipe is going to be on the blog. The cocktail today is the Masquerade Heartthrob, and it's got vodka, a little raspberry puree, some grapefruit juice, a splash of soda, and Angostura bitters. And I'm making mine right now. I was waiting, but I'm going to have it. And I'm going to pour it, and then we're going to get to listen to Chandel read. Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, awesome. Well, I'm just going to start out with the first poem in the book, and it's The Imprecision of Language. And the I am is in parentheses, so you can read the title as either The Imprecision of Language or The Precision of Language.
Mm.
How far the ring-necked dove is from wringing a dove's neck. The way a stand of trees can hide a deer stand, concealing the hunter who will shoot the deer. The deer who will fall in the fallow field. Once someone who was dear to me threatened me with a deer rifle, cleaned it random times out of season when he was upset, said, "I don't want to be divorced. We can make this work," while working the polishing cloth along the metal barrel of the gun. My blood barreled through my body when I would see his truck in the drive. I was never not scared to come home, to fall asleep, to say the least little thing wrong. Language became a tricky game where saying nothing meant everything, where saying everything meant nothing left to fear. I sang my sorrow to anyone who recognized the panic of birdsong, the desperation of the killdeer feigning its broken wing, anything to lure the predator from its nest. Its broken wing was strength. I shone my brokenness like a flare gun. Someone might understand the bird of my heart always crashing against the cage of my ribs, the moth of hidden fear fluttering to escape from my throat. Once in my Shakespeare class, I learned that brace meant a pair, a brace of kinsmen, of harlots, of greyhounds, a brace of warlike brothers. In another time, I stood at the front of the classroom in a chest brace because my husband had collapsed the cartilage between my ribs. I couldn't reach the string on the movie screen and had to ask for help. I said, "I'm wearing a brace, so I can't stretch." I thought of the grimace stretching across the nurse's face when I said, "I know this sounds like domestic violence. It was an accident, just goofing around." I wrapped the Velcro belt around my ribs each morning as he ribbed me. I should have given up. What was I trying to prove, staying in a submission hold until he cracked my ribs? Was I stupid or just stubborn? I didn't know he was grooming me for greater violence. The rock thrown at me in the car, the wedding ring pressed so tight by his hand holding mine until I bled. Which brings us back to the dove, the difference between ringing and ringing, and where language leaves us when someone controls every word we say, when we have no one left to talk to. So I think I'll just sort of skip around a little bit. This poem is one Gaza family observes a grim holiday in wartime, and it is after the story of the same title on NPR's All Things Considered. Yesterday, my son learned to open the deadbolt. upset about his toys forgotten at daycare. He slipped out the front door while I was changing clothes. Tried to go back to get them himself. When I came out of the bedroom, he was gone. For those 2 minutes, my heart stopped until I scooped him up crying in the driveway. Today, I thought of the mothers of Gaza. We listened to the news while driving to daycare. One Palestinian child dead every hour. A reporter was interviewing a family celebrating Eid al-Fitr. There are 53 people staying in this three-bedroom apartment, including 8 babies. At the sound clip of the babies crying, Liam asked, "Baby, are you all right?" The reporter is the same one who interviewed me about my first book, who helped me dismantle the violence of my childhood. I want her to be safe, this woman I spent a few hours with in a radio studio, a few minutes with on the phone. I want the babies to be safe, their mothers, their fathers. I don't believe in a God, neither Christian, nor Jewish, nor Muslim, but I believe in the peace that can inhabit a human heart. Meanwhile, in the story, a 4-year-old boy chooses his holiday present, a toy gun. He delights in the rat-a-tat of the rifle fire. And then, since you guys mentioned social media, here is a social media poem, Unfriending the Dead, because I think we all kind of go through this now where we're not sure what to do when someone on our Facebook friends list dies. Unfriending the Dead. They show up in the news feed, Facebook as memorial, birthday reminders, events where the guest of honor will never appear. Someone who is forgotten or who hasn't heard will leave a joyful eat cake, a copied and pasted happy birthday. Even just the letters HBD in our light speed world. Still not so far away from lost messengers in ancient times. Letters gone down at sea or never delivered because of a lame horse. But others, miss you, mama. It's been hard. This earth isn't the same without you on it. Sometimes I think about the ways we die. Cancer, car accident, suicide, 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 suicide. I think of the body hanging, the children unknowing on the other side of the door while the blood stops traveling, the cells shut down without oxygen. This is all very mechanical. It is just lights going out on a cellular level, the same way pixels spark out of my LED screen, sending their image and are then shut down. Some days I want to type, "I saw your son in the school concert. He was wonderful. You would be so proud." Or, "The earth misses the weight of your terrible beauty." Is this the modern way of planting flowers in a cemetery? Placing stones on a grave? Is the digital world temperate or desert? Victorians must have felt this way about photographs, and before this, paintings. How are we always inventing ways to keep the dead with us? Why is it so hard to let the cursor hover over unfriend, block? How permanently to release you, to make room for more, to keep the pixels of you from my screen the way the tiny lights of your body turned out one by one by one. So I am just flipping through. I feel like this is a Heather poem, like she would really like this. I don't really usually read this one, but I'm going to for you guys.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Yay. I'm excited.
Oh, good. Thank you. this is called Friends 1991, and it is after Ken Fontenot. Ken Fontenot has a poem, I think it's Friends 1956, about what it was like to be coming of age in 1956. So this is my Friends 1991. We were desperate sex in girls' bodies. We were girls mothers warned sons about. We were handcuffed together to a bed at a party, sent home together in a cab from a field trip. We were barns burning for anyone's love. We were lonely walks to the cemetery and talking to graves, blowjobs behind tombstones, always hoping to get caught, always dreaming of escape. We were talks on the hood of a car, dreaming up early dramatic deaths, scared shitless of ending up pregnant or poor or fat or all three. We were learning to drive a stick shift on gravel roads while eating ice cream, flirting for freebies from sweat nervous boys at restaurants. We couldn't have lived any different. We couldn't have saved one another. We were just trying to survive the only way we knew how. And then, since we talked about like influences, this is after Robert Frost's Out Out. So the title is the last two lines of Out Out. And they, since they were not the one dead, turned to their affairs. Out Out is the one where the boy is helping cut firewood and cuts his hand off and bleeds to death. Mm-hmm. And I always feel like that ending, and they, since they were not the one dead, turned to their affairs. I feel like people sort of maybe read Robert Frost wrong. I know that sounds really presumptuous of me to say, but I feel like he was just writing about farm life. Like, even if someone dies, you have to keep doing stuff. And that doesn't, well, you know what I mean? That doesn't necessarily mean that you're not grieving, but, you know, like, cows need to be milked. Chickens need to be fed. Yeah. So here's my sort of version of that poem. Every creak becomes a swinging rope, the halo of light cradling him as he hung in the barn's large doorway. The way her screams felt like they were coming from somewhere else. She remembers everything about his neck, putting her nose in the crook between head and shoulder, breathing him in the first time. All the times she worried when he would wear her necklaces, play with neckties, all her fears about that fragile stem. When he was first learning to sit up, she would put him on a blanket, watch his head follow her like a flower tracking the sun. Later, it was sunscreen and aloe. It was learning to tie a tie, then medals for track and senior keys, straightening his bow tie for prom, and lastly, the purple when the paramedics cut him down. How do the mothers go on? The ones who still see the ball chased into the street, who pass the bike helmet on the hook, dust the trophies on the shelves of bedrooms, never, ever entered except sometimes. And so I am going to read kind of another social media poem. I kind of think of this as like a badass feminist poem. I hope you guys do also.
I'm in for that.
Okay. It's called I'm Not a Narrative for Your Entertainment, because there was a male poet who, when things would happen in my life on social media, he would ask, like, what's going on? Like, I was a TV show. And it was just so weird to me. And later on, it came out that he actually was like just a huge Me Too story. And he actually went to jail. Yeah. So ladies, do not ignore those red flags. So this is, I am not a narrative for your entertainment. The male poet asks, why are you single? What's the narrative? Like, I'm a show he's been meaning to catch up on. The male poet says, remember the sexy poems you used to write? You're not writing mommy poems now, are you? I want to tell him even my mommy poems are too sexy for him, especially too sexy. I know because the tongues that have flickered over my C-section incision have told me. My abdomen, like Zeus's head, has sprung warriors. And if that's not sexy, then nothing goddamned is. I want to tell him I'm single because I'm a beautiful disaster. Not the little match girl, but the whole fireworks factory ablaze. You can watch me burn for miles. Hear about it on the national news. My every move is a trending topic on Facebook and Twitter. You just didn't know because you'd been blocked from my universe. And I will just read a few pelican poems since we talked about Eastern Oregon and the pelicans on the Umatilla River frequently feel like they are my friends. So I'll read part one. And actually where this poem came from is I was running along the river one day and I saw a flock of pelicans, which was unusual at that time for this part of the country. And I was like, wow, that's a lot of pelicans. And so I actually counted them and there were 13, which felt like a sign because of like 13 ways of looking at a blackbird. So I wrote 13 pelican poems. So here's part one. The lone pelican in the reeds of river's edge seemed odd. I stopped, watched, did nothing. Later in the paper, the story of its broken wing, likely caused by flying into a wire, that it would probably be euthanized. When you see a pelican alone, it usually means something is wrong, said the wildlife expert. My self-doubt that kept me from calling. Did I cause that pelican more hours of suffering or gift it a few more hours of floating in the reeds, a little while longer to bob in the gentle current, the coolness of water over webbed feet? Forgive me, pelican. I also am always alone. Also, fly too recklessly for my own good.
I know this story. Didn't I see something about this on your social media, Shandel?
You did. Yeah. And actually, I saw a pelican by itself. And so for people who are not familiar with the craziness of my social media, there was a pelican by itself again this year. And so I posted it and I was so upset. And everyone was like, oh, go to the river, you know, and see if the pelican's okay. Because the wildlife people had said, well, let us know if it's still there tomorrow. Sometimes they just have like a slight injury, like they're tired or a pulled muscle and they rest and then they catch up with their flock. And so I did see the pelican again and it actually looked like he caught up with his flock. So
Oh, good.
Yeah, I know, because it's so heartbreaking. You know, I don't know if they can do anything to help them if they are hurt. So when you see them, it's just, and they're majestic. They have like 9-foot wingspan. I'm going to read one more pelican poem to end our reading. And something that's interesting to me is when you write a poem about something to then go back and write a poem of absence without it. So one day I was imagining what the river is without the pelicans. So this is part seven. But what is the river without the pelicans? It is still the herons stalking minnows in the reeds and the two trees where the 12 nests rest beyond the picnic pavilion. It is the osprey hovering above the river and the Pacific power linemen who built the new nesting platform while the osprey wintered in South America. It is the wood ducks and mallards, the flit and sea song of red-winged blackbird, the slate arrows of doves that throw themselves down to river's edge after seeds. It is otter and mink, the deer that come down from the ridge, the cattle from open range who amble down mountain on hot days. It is coho and chinook, steelhead and salmon. The train tracks which follow the river from Gibbon to Rivermouth, where one night a boy lay his head, and later in the high school gym, I hugged his mother and said, I'm so sorry about your son. The river is every single body that has been pulled out of it, the ghosts that walk the levee. But today, there were pelicans, two breeding pairs, so we move on. So I think I'll end there. The so we move on seems like the natural ending.
I'm so glad you read the Pelson Pelican poems. I'm in New Orleans, and so we have pelicans here, and it'll be amazing. You'll be driving along a bridge and look over, and there's one just flying right next to you.
Oh, so cool. And you guys have the brown pelicans, right?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have the white ones that have the black fringe on their wings. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of survivalism in your poems, a lot of women's safety narratives. Can you talk about those themes in this collection a little bit?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting because as a woman, if you are at all outdoorsy, and I would say I'm probably more outdoorsy than the average American woman, but like in Oregon, there are women who go out into the woods for a month and don't see people, you know. So I'm not that. I'm not like hunting. Like I will fish, I will harvest food and can food and stuff like that. But I think if you are an outdoorsy woman, there is a narrative that that's dangerous for you. Like if you're going hiking or camping, people will say alone, and they don't do that to men, right?
Right.
But statistically, the most dangerous place for a woman to be is in a home with a husband, you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah, because of domestic violence and so many women being killed by intimate partners. And I shouldn't even have to say this, but obviously that's not all men. There are people who are in safe relationships. But to me, that dichotomy of people acting like being outdoors is dangerous when statistics say being at home with a male partner is the most dangerous place a woman could be, I just think that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's kind of beautiful that you feel like women are safer in nature in some respects, because I think a lot of us are just really fearful of being alone in nature. But you're right. The urban jungle is worse sometimes. So, Shandell, this was amazing. I'm so excited that we got to hear you reading your work. Before we let you go today, can you let us know what you're working on in the next year or two? Are there any projects that are striking you as emergent? You know, just tell us a little about what comes next for you.
I am just trying to write like crazy. There's a handout that I give my students called Write Like Crazy. And I know some people don't like the use of the word crazy, but I think any creative endeavor is, I don't know how to say it. Any creative endeavor is sort of like not in reality, not rational, and therefore is a little crazy, if that makes sense. Yeah. So I am really writing a lot of fiction and flash fiction now. And it's not necessarily a conscious thing. I guess I just feel like I have 3 books of poems out and I feel very established as a poet. And I just don't want to forget that there are other things to write. Mm-hmm. So I have a story coming out in November in Friction, which has that parentheses around the R. So it can be either Friction or Fiction. And I'm so excited. It's called 7 Times Maria Van Sant Felt Beautiful. And it's just a story that I'm really excited about. And I've just been...
Congratulations. That's wonderful.
Yeah, thank you. It's one that I wrote in Kathy Fish's workshop. And I've just been, you know, sending out work from that workshop. I'm trying to think, I guess I'm really in kind of a reflective place right now, like a lot of us are. Mm-hmm. Where I'm just trying to figure out how we live life in this like new normal. Yeah.
And just process.
Exactly. And for me, a lot of processing isn't necessarily art or literary, but it's very active. You know, like when it was mushroom season, I went out into the woods with my family and we learned how to harvest mushrooms and learned how to cook with mushrooms. Mm-hmm. And now we're mountain biking and hiking and, you know, doing things just to make sure that we aren't sort of indoors and depressed
Since we're drinking your custom cocktail, I wanted to ask you one last little question. If you have coffee or tea or cocktail or drink that you like to have when you're writing, what's sitting next to your paper or computer when you write?
Oh my goodness, it really depends. friends. Like, I am definitely just a coffee with whole milk person in the morning. And then I really love beer. I mean, my last name is Beers. So I went to beer school, not to be a brewer, but just to like learn about different kinds of beer and beer tasting. And so I've just been trying all kinds of different microbrews.
Have you been enjoying all the sours and all the gozes and all that stuff that's out now?
I'm not a sours person. I really like, I mean, since it's summer, there are a lot of nice, crisp beers out there. So Mother Earth Brewing is a company that I think people should look at. And since it is Hot Redhead Media, they have a beer called Just Call Me Ginger that is like ginger and I forget what else, but it's like just a nice summer.
Anything with ginger is pretty wonderful.
Yeah, it's a great beer. So yeah, I've just been trying different beers while I...
Oh, that's so funny. I'm like drinking tons of espresso right now.
Yeah, I would probably have a hummingbird heart tachycardia and die or something if I was doing espresso all the time.
Well, Shandel, this has been a lovely session. Your reading was a little bit like a cleanse with fire and I enjoyed it so much. I can't even tell you. It was so lovely for our audience out there. Thanks so much for spending time with us at Book Tales today. We enjoyed hearing your work. Everybody go get Shandel's book, Secure Your Own Mass. Be sure to check out hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the Book Tales readings and drinks for this podcast series. And subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month, for more conversations with amazing literary authors. I'm not kidding. We've got an amazing lineup coming. So go and check that out on the site. And thanks so much for joining us today. See you next time. We'll be right back.